Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome back to Seniors in Tech, a mini-series where we bust stereotypes by talking to seniors who either worked in the tech industry at the beginning of the digital era or are currently tech-fluent in their everyday lives. I'm Dr. Nikki Ackermans, and this week we are talking to Michael Musial, who worked in the high-tech industry since the late 70s and has even had some of his tech get into space. Can you go ahead and just introduce yourself and give us your senior cred and your tech cred?
Well, I don't know what counts as cred, but my name's Michael Musial. I worked my way up through the ranks. Although I've got an engineering background and education, I do not have a degree. So I want to put that disclaimer out there right now. I started out as an electronics tech in several companies and worked my way up into design over the years. And not having the degree has been a little bit of a limiting factor, but I have come to the conclusion if a company's not going to respect my experience, then the degree doesn't mean anything to me as far as whether they're going to accept me or not.
Yeah, because the experience is kind of the important part in the end.
Yep. So I've had a couple of flat-out turndowns over the years, but at the same time, I've interviewed with Apple a couple of times. The deciding factor for not going is the people I talked to wanted me to relocate, and I really like where I live. So I prefer to be living up here next to Lake Superior and a little different style of life up here.
Yeah, it sounds beautiful already from what I've heard from you. So you started out in the late 70s from what I grasp, and what
Correct.
Made you want to go into tech at the time?
Well, it goes back before that. I had sent you a note that I actually was starting to build stuff in electronics in third grade. I wanted a metal detector and couldn't afford one on my paper route money. So I decided I was going to build one.
And, sure, as one does.
Yeah, well, a lot of geeks out there will understand that. So eventually got into what I needed to build my first metal detector and got into ham radio. In ham radio, there's a term called an ELMer, and that's a mentor. They kind of guide you through studying.
Okay.
And he was a senior engineer that I have a great deal of respect for. He has since passed. And he did his best when he found out I kind of liked this engineering thing and wanted to become an engineer. He did everything he could to dissuade me from being one. And when I still insisted on becoming an engineer, he said, well, okay, if you're going to do it, you're going to learn how to do it right. So
good man.
It started back in eighth grade of middle school there and kind of never looked back.
You made it all the way up to R&D manager for US Robotics. How was the path to get there if you didn't go get your degree? I guess you just tested a few different companies, picking up things that you liked, and then you went to robotics?
Yeah.
A big generalization, I guess, of a lot of years of your life, I'm sure.
Yeah, there's a lot happened in between. You know, the magic happened between point A and point B. But before US Robotics, I had been with a company called Jerome Teleconferencing and Teleconferencing Technologies for a number of years. And although my background is mostly analog and RF, I got involved in digital electronics and programming in the early 80s. So it gave me an understanding of both sides of the equation. So I not only understood the digital side of what needed to get done, but I understood had a good understanding of that black magic known as analog.
Yeah, that helps. Did you also have some of the, I guess if you started out from home, did you also have some of the digital like tech at home as well? Or was it more work?
Well, I started out building, you know, radio equipment and rebuilding old stuff in World War II and making an amateur radio gear out of it. But in the late 70s, I bought this kit and built what was called a Cosmac Elf 2, one of the first personal computers, if you want to call it that.
You did a really first computer build.
Yep. And that kind of got me hooked. Is like, I hooked all these parts up together and they worked the first time. That's unheard of.
Wow.
Yeah. But with US Robotics, I had been in telecom for a number of years and got really involved in digital signal processing and echo cancellation, because we were doing full duplex speaker phones. And this is before the days of Polycom and the names that you'd recognize today, mm-hmm. And audio conference bridges. So I was designing that and working with various telecom companies around the US and in Europe. And the company I worked for was purchased by another company, and they relocated to the East Coast, and I didn't want to move. Yeah. So a good friend of mine, going back to the seniors in tech mode, by the way, I'm just shy of 62, so there's a lot older ones out there than me.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't think I'm that old, but yeah. Anyhow, when I start talking about modems and people's eyes glaze over, it's like, okay, maybe. But one of my friends in tech had sold a gentleman by the name of Michael Seidman. And if you look him up, he was senior vice president of US Robotics at the time. But at one time in life, my friend had sold Michael Seidman a Radio Shack Tandy TRS-80 computer out of his garage. And he sent Michael Seidman an email out of the blue saying, hey, I've got a friend that's got TI-DSB experience, and I've known him for a long time, and I think you're looking for engineers. So Michael Seidman hired me sight unseen.
That's a great friend.
Yep. And I got stuck right in R&D. Now, I was a R&D manager. There are a lot of R&D people at US Robotics, but I was in the personal communications division. I was there when they made the transition from the 32K Sportster up to 56K modems. Still slow by today's standards, but it was a good experience.
Yeah. And are there some R&D moments that stand out for you at that specific company?
Probably the biggest one is the group I was in came up with one of, again, everything's just everybody builds on everybody else's work.
Of course.
But our group had a patent of internet telephony, which is partially the predecessor to what you would consider Wi-Fi calling today.
Yeah.
But, so it was a whole process of, okay, digitizing audio and putting it over the internet. There's no real magic there other than understanding what it takes to do it. But it was the whole process of determining the server systems and everything else to be able to coordinate phone numbers to IP addresses and how to coordinate all this on the internet. And that patent was filed, I think, initially in 96, 97, something like that. That took a while for it to go through the system. Okay. That's probably the biggest thing I took away from US Robotics is I still have my name on that patent, along with the rest of the members on the team.
That's pretty cool. I guess, that's kind of a cool thing to have, that you could say that you did that.
It's fun. I've been real fortunate. And the one thing that was unique about US Robotics is when an engineer came up with an idea that was worthwhile, they actually gave you some pretty good bonuses for it. A lot of companies, you get a plaque with your name on it and maybe a check for a dollar that you had a patent. And that's one area I've been real fortunate in. I've got 13 patents over my career. Most of them, I think, have expired as far as protected.
Oh, right.
At this point, but still.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
I've got the list out there.
Anything else that people would recognize?
The simplest one I've got out there, and probably made the most royalties of, because it was a family owned company. And when this patent came out, they rewarded everybody very well.
Nice.
It's called a signal mirror patent. And if you see turn signals in the outside rear view mirror, that's how I actually was able to afford to move to where I live now.
Oh, cool. I'm going to have to think about that now every time I'm driving.
I still think about it when I see it on the road. It's like, hey, cool. I know what
that's
that is.
Me. That's amazing. Okay. So patent making actually does reward sometimes, not all the time.
Yeah. It's for most companies, it's an excuse to be able to sue each other. And I have been through many depositions as well. And that's the part that's not fun with patents.
Yeah. I I bet. So yeah, you wrote in your background that you had these audio teleconferencing devices, the automotive electronics. I guess that's part of the turning signal thing.
Yep. Some of it. Yep. And the other one in the automotive electronics was it's called a night vision patent, but it's actually all weather. It okay. sees through snow, smoke, rain, and darkness. And that one, I don't know if it's ever been implemented by the company after I left it, but it wound up getting me into some rather interesting design situations because we wound up working with the Russian military with the invitation of the Kremlin. So I actually worked in Moscow over two periods of time at the invitation of the Kremlin, who
what
sponsored my visa.
What year was this?
Let's see here. That would have been 2003 and okay. 2006.
Okay, it's better that it's more recent, I guess, because if not, things start to get a little bit tense. Was it kind of tense to go work for Russia?
No. I mean, it was a different experience for me, but it was at the invitation of the Kremlin and with the approval of the State Department. I mean, there were a lot of I's the dot and T's the cross. And that wasn't actually my first experience with Russia. It'd be early 90s. I was involved with a company called American Innovation Computers. And if you looked it up today, other companies have taken on that name. But we were the only U.S. company authorized to sell high-tech computers to Russia. And they were used for the Russian space program.
So you made stuff that's been into space.
Made stuff that helped put things up in space. And yes, we actually did the physical testing for some gear that went up in Mir that was used for the inventory system up there. And one of the other companies I worked with outside, out in California by the name of Vadim had a product called the Clio 1000 and the Clio 1050. And it was also marketed as the Sharp Mobilon tripod. And a Linux version of that device made it up on the ISS. And I've got a picture.
What does that exactly do?
It's think of it as a predecessor to an iPad, except this was back in the late 90s. It had a touchscreen. I'm trying to remember the name of the group that Paragraph. Paragraph had joined Vadim, and they were doing handwriting recognition. This device you could actually physically just write in longhand on it would transcribe your badly, but it would transcribe what you were writing. And then it had a flip out full QWERTY keyboard underneath.
Wow, that's pretty cutting edge for the time, actually.
Yeah, complete with Wi-Fi and a modem. So it was an interesting device. And again, it was used up on the ISS, I believe, mostly for inventory control and such. But I've got a picture of the flight commander holding it. And the picture that was, to put this in a time frame, the picture of the flight commander holding that Clio was 3 days before 9/11.
Okay.
I looked at the timestamp on that. I'm like, wow, things changed just a few days after that picture was sent.
Yeah, weird how different events overlap like that. So, okay, Russia. So you've lived in a bunch of places and you finally settled where you are now because it seems to be beautiful and amazing. And you set up the internet connection for where you live, like the whole island where you live. Is that correct?
This part of it. Now, it's known as the Keweenaw Peninsula, but there's one bridge on and off. So in my book, that's called an island. In old maps, you'll actually see it called Copper Island. It's about 50 miles from end to end. It's pretty good size. So it's an hour drive down to the bridge from here. And again, not me single-handedly, but a group of us. But when I was first coming up here for work purposes, I've been coming up here since 1974. Mm. But with the intent of when we bought the house and living up here, and at the time I was still with US Robotics, we only had dial up at 22K. And to say that was painful was an understatement.
I can imagine.
So I joined up with a group called Pasty, and we started making microwave links because at the time there wasn't even any fiber on the island at all. Mm. And we were doing hilltop to hilltop microwave links to bring internet up to the county. And initially the first link to the county was only 10 megabit for the entire county.
Not great.
Yeah. Now, I mean, it's still by city standards, so, but we're offering 25 meg down, 5 meg up for people in log cabins in the woods now. So it's quite usable, actually.
Man, you have really like fortunate neighbors who probably benefit from your need for high-speed internet.
Yeah, there's a 300 meg dish about 50 feet to my left up on a tower right now in my office here.
And that's why your connection is so great.
That's my connection, and it also supplies the state park up here and many of the neighbors around me. I'm also the rural paramedic up here. It's a very small area, but when I'm not running down the road in the ambulance, I'm climbing up hills, working on microwave links that are either solar or wind powered, and get to do that year round. So when I'm not climbing up in the summer, I'm snowshoeing up in the winter. It keeps me in good shape.
Yeah, I can imagine. You're really like the all-around helper guy for your community, it actually seems like.
Well, again, that's everybody here.
Right. I could see how that would work.
As I said in the background, this particular community is 90 people year-round. During the summer, it's a major summer vacation destination. Mm. But we still have a one-room schoolhouse. It's still in operation, has been since the 1800s. So there's a long, old history in this town. And everybody has to wear multiple hats to make it work.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point on the price-performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Haiku is the fastest and lowest-cost model in the market, perfectly designed for high-volume, high-speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to keep them at the frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Sounds like a cool place to live. So you're still, aside being a paramedic and maintaining the internet and all of that, you're also still developing software and hardware?
Yes, I am. In between contracts right now, but they tend to, a big project tends to come up. I'll spend a year or two with it, with a company. That's kind of the way startups go. And then I'll kind of settle back in. I'm reaching the point now where I'm semi-retired, but I'm never going to stop.
It's hard.
I'd show you. This room is an absolute mess right now, but considering I am 230 miles from the nearest interstate right now, I have full surface mount capability in the bench next to me. So I do hardware prototyping here, write the software to support it, and do a lot of testing locally here.
And what kind of hardware, just in general?
The last stuff I did was ARM-based with 9-axis orientation on it for a product called Zensar. And that was a device a little bigger than a half dollar and a quarter inch thick that you would mount on your mountain bike or your surfboard or kite board or whatever sport you're in. And even just, I used to put it in my hat when I was running. Mm-hmm. And it would record for 6 hours. And it had a very sensitive, very accurate GPS on it, complete with Bluetooth. And when you got back, it would download to your computer and it would give you a full 3D recording of what you just did. So it would show you the trails you were on, how high you jumped on jumps, what kind of G-forces you had on them.
Sounds awesome.
And it was actually used in another space application, but I think there's it wasn't designed for it, but it was a high G device. And I think there's an NDA there that prevents me from saying who used it, but it's kind of cool to see that it's still.
That is cool. That's really cool. And I wonder, so you're still obviously doing all of this very, and very, very high tech. Like this is like high tech. For me.
There's always somebody more high tech.
How does it feel to be so considered a senior in tech? And some people might go ahead and assume you don't even know how to work an iPhone. And so what is that like?
Well, most of the people up here, other than some guys call me and some families actually say, hey, the cable guy's here. So a lot of the residents of town know my background, but in general, a lot of people have no idea what I did before I came here. Although there was one other paramedic when I first started with the service up here, and I've been with the service going on 14 years, who actually took the time to go on the internet and just did a Google search on me. And he showed up at the station house one night. And he said, "What the heck are you doing here?" And I said, "It's all quality of life." I've had numerous opportunities to relocate out to the West Coast. My wife is a horse trainer, by the way.
Cool.
And we had an Arabian horse farm in eastern side of Wisconsin before we moved up here. And one of the startups I was working with out in the West Coast at one point flew my wife out and my 1-year-old oldest son. And they actually offered to buy our horse farm and replace it with a horse farm in San Jose.
Wow. They were very, very interested.
They were interested. But my wife came out for a couple of months and said, "Hey, this is cool, but I don't want to live here. So you do what you want." And I was like, "Well, that kind of decides it for me."
Yeah, that makes things kind of complicated.
Where she was at. So yeah. That situation's come up a couple of times. I've been involved in several startups in the West Coast. What I can say, because it shows up in Google, is when Dalles Lake Microsystems moved out to the West Coast, to San Jose, when they relocated from Ottawa, Canada. I was the very first employee there, and I was the chief tech officer for about a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And it got to the point where they wanted to take things to the next level and say, "Okay, it's time for you to move out here." And I was like, "No, I'm sorry. I just can't do this."
Yeah.
So it's why we parted ways. I love visiting California. I love doing design work out there. But as long as I can live here, I don't mind going out for doing design reviews. But that's kind of where
it seems like you've made it work anyways.
Yep.
So it's not too big of a deal that people will think that you actually don't realize that you do tech. Do you still, in your everyday life, use a lot of tech that's not work-oriented, but maybe like, I don't know, the newest iPhone or whatever, Android?
I do pretty much stick with iPhone, just a personal preference. There's no political agenda there one way or the other. I have done Android development in the past as well, but... our entire family is iPhone, especially when the kids were in school. Cell phone coverage is almost non-existent up here, but you can find Wi-Fi from place to place. So the way to stay in touch with our kids, iMessage works in Wi-Fi really well. But a lot of before Wi-Fi calling came out, SMS wasn't working unless you had a cell phone connection. That's kind of changed a bit. But most of the tech stays right here in the office. I've been self-employed contractor at least half of my career. It keeps winding up where I'll be doing contracting for a company and they eventually bring me on for a few years. And I think the longest stint I've done is 10 years at one place as an employee, but I prefer to be self-employed. I learned way too late in the game that you can't do it out of your house and really walk away from work. And I think a lot of people are realizing this after the last year of the pandemic. I'm very fortunate. My garage office here is 1,000 feet from our cabin. Okay. And the tech stays here. The cabin, yes, I've got Wi-Fi there, and we stream Netflix, and we don't have cable or satellite or anything. It's all streamed over the internet back at the cabin. But it's a one bedroom cabin. It's 750 square feet. It's where we raised our boys.
Wow,
so pretty cozy. But we're also in a considerable chunk of woods here, and
it's a really interesting interface between very high tech and very low tech. But it seems to be the perfect balance. Yeah,
yeah. During the state cross-country ski trails come within 200 feet of our property. So especially when the kids were in school, I'd get them on the bus. And there's one school bus for the entire county. So it starts at our driveway. It used to. Both my sons are now adults. I guess that's where the seniors in tech thing comes in again. Time goes on. But they'd get on the bus at 5 a.m. And then I would just stay up here at the office, make myself a cup of coffee and get going. But I generally feel pretty comfortable taking a break at 3 p.m. And I pull out my dad's old Norwegian skis and wax them up and go skiing at 3 p.m.
Sounds amazing. I'm going to aim for this quality of life.
And I'm also in a destination for mountain biking up here. So I do a lot of that, both recreationally and as pulling people off trails as a paramedic.
Because how else are you going to reach them?
Yeah. Yep.
Since you kind of were there at the beginning of the digital era, things have changed a lot over time, and you were there for a lot of it because you were working in all of this. So how was it to watch this whole evolution of a type of technology during your career?
It's been pretty amazing. Again, there's always somebody doing something more sophisticated than you, and you can't know it all. Sure. That's always been a situation of I learn things as I need it, and you kind of go from there. But in the late 70s, I was doing work for a distributor for a company called Ohio Scientific, and they were the other personal computer company. There was this other upstart out there called Apple, and we kind of consider ourselves competitors. I think one of them did better than the other. But Ohio Scientific was pretty innovative for the time. But the computer back then was a bare board computer with a QWERTY keyboard on it and no case. So we've come a long ways. I did a lot of consulting for businesses that were running computers. Back then it was CPM and MPM. And DOS was just starting to come out. And this is before the IBM PC. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times, especially when I was living out in the Arizona area, a company will want to add a printer to their computer. And I would actually have to wire wrap a circuit board and write a driver so they could plug their Centronics compatible interface into their computer and do printouts. So things before you really had to be able to cookbook things to get things to work.
Yeah.
And the fact that things are plug and play, no pun intended there, these days. Late 70s, early 80s, it wasn't unusual to go in and pull circuit boards out and plug them back in to get the oxide off the contacts, and sometimes pull ICs out of their sockets and put them back in. And that was just considered normal to keep a computer running. So the reliability and the ruggedness of the equipment today compared to where things were in the 70s, 80s is just amazing. Nobody thinks twice about dropping an iPhone, you know, unless it happens to land on a rock and crack the screen. But you just assume it's going to continue working.
Mm-hmm.
That's
what
a big
happened
change
if you would drop one of those old Ohio Scientific computers.
It wouldn't work.
It would shatter into a million pieces.
You'd have to align the floppy disk drive just so it would even read the disks.
I guess people don't really think about how things are a lot more accessible now as well. You don't particularly have to be that great at tech to figure out how to run a PC.
And it's much more affordable. The first hard drives that I was working with were rack mount. And the Okidata 80 megabyte hard drive was $10,000 back in the early 80s. And the very first hard drive I had for my Zenith Data Systems PC, that was the IBM clone. I was living high in the hog with a 10 megabyte hard drive.
Wow. How much stuff can you save on a 10 megabyte? What are you even using that for, actually?
Well, back then there was a lot of space, but you weren't storing high definition graphics or anything else like that. You could write a lot of programs under a couple K in code. So again, things have changed. It's storage. Most of my background is assembly code and, digital signal processing and a lot of C code. That's very efficient coding. These days with graphic user interfaces and everything else, you could have, a gigabyte in a program. And a lot of games out there that people are playing either on their iPads or iPhones or their desktop computers are many gigabytes in size.
Yeah.
So, and we don't even think twice about it anymore.
No, it's just an app and it's fine.
Yep.
I think it's really important to just see how these things are evolving and how you're also just staying at the forefront of it, because for some reason, some people just assume that it's not for my generation, so I don't need to think about it. But actually, if you're there from the beginning, you can keep up with it.
Some of the retired people I know up here are extremely high tech. They it can go either way, but they've got, I wouldn't say time in their hands, because some of the busiest people I know are retired. But but if they want to make time for it, they're digging into stuff and then asking me questions. It's like, I don't know, I'm going to have to look it up in Google. And they're like, what? And I said, well, it's to me, Google is the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It's the place to look everything up and figure out how things work. That's another thing that's changed considerably. You know, in the 80s, looking something up online was not a thing. So it was quite a project to go out there and try to research something.
Yeah, how do you figure out how to code? If you do, you have to go to the library?
Yes, I did. Spend a lot of time at the library.
Okay, because now I complain when I have to spend a day figuring out why my code isn't working on Google. But maybe I shouldn't complain so much.
My first code was stored on punched tape. That and Hollerith punch cards, but our high tech ones were punch tape. They're reels of punch tape. And we would write the code, punch it out, and it would be loaded into the processing system because the memory was it had to be powered up. You lost power, you lost the program. So then you had to reload it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then we had these electric drills on our belts that would reload, re-spin the tape back up in the reel after we loaded it into the computer.
it's such a different system, yeah, from what we have today. It's so weird to think about this like physical memory as these punch cards.
Firmware was very expensive back in the beginning, and it was not easy to reprogram. The original PROMs were just that. They were fusible links. So once you burn the firmware in, that was it.
Forever.
If you wanted to change the firmware, you had to go in there and pull the IC out and put a new one in.
Oh, okay.
And then they came up with the UV erasable ones. Mm-hmm. And you'd pull the chip out, put it under UV light for 15, 20 minutes and reprogram it. But even then, it was a big deal to do a BIOS update or do a firmware update.
Yeah, it's not automatic download and restart like we have now. It's interesting to see how much more work everything was back then, basically. Although I guess now it's just a different kind of work.
It's definitely a different kind of work. When I was still active in the corporate level, I was one of the few guys that still had I always insisted on having a full workbench behind me. Mm-hmm. Most design these days is done by CAD. You know, you model everything on the computer. But for me, I do the modeling, I do everything else, but there's still no substitute for actually building it on the bench and trying it out for my own personal preference.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you had a preference for how it was done before, how it's done now, but I guess that answers that.
And it's good for prototyping, but the scale of things today, you can simulate it on a bench to a certain extent when you build something, but everything is so small, you can't simulate that on a bench.
Yeah, but you could start out, I guess, on the bench and then get your precision higher in CAD or whatever. Hmm. What is your favorite piece of tech that you've either worked on or own or just seen?
Boy, that's tough. my favorite product I ever worked on was the Zenser. It's still something that's in progress, but being able to take something that I was writing Bluetooth stacks and GPS software and then going out. And part of my job is to go out and mount
test
it to
it
a mountain bike and go out there with the blessing of the company and just beat on it. It was a blast. We actually did the company that I did that design for, and it was another one of those situations where I contracted with them for years and they brought me on as a salary engineer after a while, but they got started out doing this. They were doing red camera and HD videos for Red Bull to qualify events that they were in, competitions they were having.
Gotcha.
And Red Bull wanted more data, more precise data. And this company got into doing sensors so they could actually digitally record what was going on in each competition, see how high that surfboard jumped in the air or that kiteboard. And I got to get involved with that shortly after they got into that technology. And I finished up the software, finished up the hardware design, actually got it in production with the company, actually got to go out with Red Bull to test this stuff. And they loved it because I was not only there to test the hardware, but they had a paramedic on scene.
Oh, yeah, so exactly.
They asked me to bring my medic gear with me when I was on these test sites. So I've gotten to, there's one in particular where they brought in world-class kiteboarders from around the world in November on Lake Superior.
Oof.
And some of these guys never seen snow before. So they're out there kiteboarding in the snow in 30 some odd degree Lake Superior waters.
Yeah,
it was a fun time. It was a fun time.
It's crazy where these origins for this tech comes from. In this case, just we want to see how high this guy's jumping.
Exactly.
Oh, that's good to hear. It seems like you've had just an all over the place career, and it's nice to for you to tell us about it and be able to reflect back on it and see how things have changed and how you're still doing pretty amazing stuff, actually. So
I just feel very lucky. You know, a good part of what's interesting in life is just paying attention to what's going on around you. And there's nothing special about me. I just happen to be in the right place at the right time and really lucky to enjoy things. I've always been an engineer that could talk to people, as you probably gathered from this interview. And so I would talk to the customers, and my clients would send me to the different approval agencies to walk it through. So if it's something failed in approvals, I could actually make the hardware or software changes on the spot. And that moved from doing approvals in the US to doing a lot of work in the UK, working with British Approvals Board. I was working in Helsinki up until the week before my wife and I got married.
Really all over the place.
And I love culture and I love architecture. So I feel very lucky to be able to travel and talk to people.
Well, speaking of talking to people, you did mention you have a podcast. So if you want to plug it, here's your chance.
It's called The Podcast That Shall Not Be Named. How that name came up is just a long story, but it's The Podcast That Shall Not Be Named. And you'll be able to find that in an RSS feed at a podcast aggregator near you. And I promise to have an episode up in the next 24 hours. Otherwise, Tom will come find me and say, why didn't you do it? So, perfect. I'll put some pressure on myself there. But I'll start plugging other versions of my podcast that I've done over the years. I've probably got it close to 1,000 episodes out there between the various different podcasts I've done. But again, it's 15 years.
Well, darn. That is very, very productive, man.
that's another old guard I belong to.
Podcasting.
The podcasting group, mostly with the Canadian podcasters, Toronto, mm-hmm. Hamilton, Montreal. That's something else that I do to keep myself sane.
Well, great. I hope people go check it out. And thanks so much for coming to give us a little chat. And maybe we'll have you on more for a longer form, because you have a lot of stories to tell, I'm sure.
I really appreciate your time.
Come back next week for the next edition of Seniors in Tech. Michael is working on The Podcast That Shall Not Be Named, so go check out his work there. You can find me hosting my own senior interview podcast over at Stories Your Granny Never Told. Next week, we talk to Sandra Foster, who learned to use computers to make her job easier as a school teacher.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great, too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.